May it please the court. My name is Amy Lowe, and I am here on behalf of Charles Zimmerman. We are here today on Election Day. This election may determine the fourth president to be in office during the pendency of Mr. Zimmerman's case. In 1997, Charles Zimmerman, at the age of 14, pled guilty under a dual jurisdiction program and was sentenced to 5 years on probation with a 20-year backup. In the year 2000, Charles was found to have violated his probation in the state of Indiana. He was brought by Missouri back to Mississippi County, Missouri, where he was sentenced to serve 120 days in a Missouri shock program. He completed his 120-day program and was sent back to Indiana again on probation. In 2003, the Circuit Court of Mississippi County became aware that Charles Zimmerman had picked up another felony case. At that time, a probation violation report was issued, state requesting delayed action with a warrant. In 2004, the first probation hearing in this case was scheduled. It was rescheduled for 2005, where the judge noted a writ would be needed to bring Mr. Zimmerman in from the Indiana Department of Corrections. Mr. Zimmerman, for his part, filed an interstate disposition against detainers request, noting that he had a probation case in Mississippi County and was currently incarcerated in Indiana, and listed his specific place of incarceration and that he had waived extradition. The court noted the writ was needed, but did not issue one. A second 2005 probation violation hearing was scheduled. It was again rescheduled. Near the end of 2005, the probation was suspended so that he would not end up timing out under 556.036. 559036, my apologies, Your Honor. After that, Mr. Zimmerman wrote again regularly, each time requesting that the court revoke his probation. Each time, the court noted that a writ should be issued and that he should be brought back, the same way he was brought back for his first probation revocation. The court knew how to procure Mr. Zimmerman and had done so before. The same judge, the Honorable David Dolan, was the judge for the entire pendency of this case.
Who legally had the responsibility to issue the writ? The court or the sheriff's office? There's some conversation about that in the briefs.
The sheriff's office never issues the writs, but what the sheriff's office did was sua sponte add that we will not extradite. The court did eventually order the sheriff's office to remove that language in 2011, but never followed up to find out if a writ was issued.
Because the state argues it was the actions of the executive branch that kept Mr. Zimmerman from being returned and their decisions rather than a failure of the circuit court to act.
The circuit court is the ultimate overseer of probation. And in the end, making sure that probation is followed as a matter of law is the responsibility of the judge. And in this case, there were multiple avenues the judge could have taken other than ordering the sheriff's department to procure Mr. Zimmerman. For instance, in 2006, Mr. Zimmerman requested the appointment of counsel. In the event that counsel had been appointed in 2006, the public defender's office could have entered and filled out the writ paperwork. The court also ordered that the prosecuting attorney fill out writ paperwork. And again, never followed up between 2011 and 2016 to see that it was done. In this case, had the court taken the reasonable step of just issuing the writ, which is only its power, no matter who prepares the writ, the one person whose signature will cause it to go to Indiana is the Honorable David Dolan.
Well, are you sure about that? I mean, looks like here we have a sheriff who put not extradite on paperwork. I mean, there's always something that there's always something that happens after the judge signs the writ. I mean, in this case, it looks like the judge was at least trying to comport with its statutory obligation.
And in this case, had the judge appointed counsel or followed up on this at some point, Your Honor, we wouldn't be in this situation because we would have writted the sheriff's office in 2006 under a writ of mandamus that they do their job, or procured a court order from the circuit court that they do their job. However, because this case was never followed up on by the sitting circuit judge, it festered for 13 years. The other consideration is that every branch of government that caused a delay in this case is on the side of the state. We have the sheriff's office, we have the prosecuting attorney, we have the actions of the sheriff's department. When we look at what the controlling test should be as to if this was a violation of Charles Zimmerman's due process rights, and we look at the majority of federal circuits that have looked as to how we rule on a due process claim for a probationer, they use an analog of the Barker test. And here, when we look at the Barker test, all of the delay is attributable to the state, to state actors. Mr. Zimmerman waives extradition. He repeatedly lets the court know where he is. He states every time he's transferred, he requests counsel so that somebody in Missouri can try to work his case through for him. But nobody responds to his requests, and nobody issues paperwork. And so he sits for 13 years.
When was his second term of probation? When did it end?
It would have ended in 2005 because no order extending it by 1 year was ever entered.
And that was the order that was entered after he was brought back from Indiana?
He was brought back from Indiana and faced, for the first one, yes, that would be the one that was the first time he was brought back from Indiana. So he's brought back from Indiana on a writ for $700 in transport costs billed to the circuit court.
And when was it?
2000.
Can you discuss the Stellis case? I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Came out of the Western District, and it held that the court was necessarily reasonable and in compliance with the statute not to bring the offender back until after his foreign sentence, because to do otherwise would be unreasonably burdensome.
Yes, Your Honor. In Stellis, which I am also not sure if I'm pronouncing correctly, the focus of the court was on making the court do onerous research in order to find a defendant and find a way to bring him back, even if we assume that Stellis is still good law and that it has not been abrogated by later decisions by the sister courts of the districts that have found that where you know how to get someone, you are obligated to do so. In this case, there is no onerous burden on the judge to find a way to get Mr. Zimmerman because we know the judge knows how to get Mr. Zimmerman. He had already done it once before.
But assuming that the state had the means to bring the offender back, was the court at fault because, as Stellis holds, it was still reasonable to wait until the offender had completed his foreign jurisdiction sentence?
Yes. I do think that when we look at the due process analysis that has been adopted by the federal circuits, that at this point the state would be at fault when the delay ends up tolling 13 years, that the only thing being requested by the probationer is revocation, and that the sole reason the probationer will now serve an extensive consecutive term of time is the delay in revoking his probation. This is not a case where we're looking at a lesser remedy, where somebody thought that they would go to a hearing and be continued. This is not a case where somebody was arguing for any other disposition other than to go to prison and to serve his time.
Do you agree the detainer statute doesn't apply to probation revocation cases?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
so
why
nothing anybody can do about that. We're solely looking at the statute, and sole consideration legally is whether or not the circuit court itself took the reasonable steps required by the statute.
By statute and by both the federal and Missouri constitutions due process clauses.
What case are you relying on that the due process requirement requires a judge to act in that fashion?
Your Honor, both the 7th, 6th, 9th, and 7th circuits explicitly have applied the due process clause to timing on probation cases, which a summary of the cases is found in Betterman versus Montana, issued by the U.S. Supreme Court this year. Also, even when you look at cases cited by the state, like Karshman, all of them recognize that there is an interest, a legitimate due process interest in a probationer in a timely resolution of probation violation cases. Harshman notes it on pages 733 to 34, noting that where concurrent time is the issue, this is where there is a real interest on the part of the probationer in a timely resolution. Here, the only reason that Mr. Zimmerman is going to do consecutive time is paperwork errors. That between the sheriff's office, the court, the prosecutor, and nobody forwarding anything to the public defender.
Well, it clearly has to be more than paperwork errors, because unless one would assume the judge never saw all of the communication from Mr. Zimmerman, because there had to have been some conscious decision to not respond to all of those requests.
Each
so that seems more than a paperwork error.
Your Honor, we do see a response to the paperwork, though, because after each filing, we see acts on the part of the court to note that somebody needs to issue a writ. Although the court doesn't write Mr. Zimmerman personally and say, hello, this is the court, we're trying to get you, the court does take what actions that it can to indicate that it wants to revoke probation then, but it doesn't take the necessary actions to actually get him.
And did it have authority to enforce its orders or to bring the sheriff before it or to hold someone in contempt if they refused to comply with its orders?
I absolutely think under Missouri law that if a sheriff refuses a valid order from a city circuit judge, that that sheriff should expect to be facing contempt charges or a writ of mandamus filed to do their duty. Here we have a huge delay. This isn't Moody versus Doggett, where we're looking at a 90-day delay, where the court still considered whether there was prejudice. This is 13 years. This is 13 years where Mr. Zimmerman did everything in his power, and this is 13 years where a simple referral of the application to the public defender's office or just issuing a writ would have solved it. And I see that I have gone over my time. If the court has no further questions.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Spillane. I represent Judge Dolan. There are really three parts to this case: due process, statutory violation, and the requirements for a writ of prohibition. I will speak about all of them at length, but I wanted to briefly go through. There's no due process violation here. This case is controlled by Moody v. Daggett and Karchman v. Nash. The cases they cite, with the exception of the Green case in 1963, aren't on point because they don't deal with a probation violator or a parole violator in a foreign jurisdiction. I could find none except Green, and Green is 1963, which is prior to Daggett and prior to Karchman. The second issue in the case is statutory violation. There are two parts that can cause a statutory violation. One is not manifesting an intent to revoke within the probation period. There's no question that didn't happen here. A capious warrant was issued during the probation period, and that is sufficient to show an intent to revoke. So then the next level of analysis is, did the court take reasonable steps to hold a revocation as soon as possible?
That's not the standard, is it? It's not just reasonable
no,
steps,
it's,
isn't it?
All reasonable. All reasonable is the language in the statute. You have the statute in front of you, but there's a modifier on reasonable.
Makes it a higher standard.
I think so. And I think the court under Stelgis and Williams, which is the cases that are on point that exist now, he followed that standard. Stelgis, as Judge Russell pointed out, is decided for two independent and adequate reasons. The first one is the court believed and found that When a person is in a foreign jurisdiction, it meets the statute to wait until the term is over. And the second reason is...
Why is that reasonable? Is there something in the law that says that, or you're saying as a matter of fact?
I'm saying that's what the Court of Appeals held in Stelgis. And you're saying, why do they
say
that?
Why is that correct?
There's a bunch of reasons. One, it's hard to get somebody back.
But here it's not. They knew exactly how they'd already done it. I understand there may be in some cases.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that analysis at all. The first time they got him back, he wasn't in jail serving a sentence in a foreign jurisdiction. He was a supervised probationer.
But isn't all reasonable steps that you attempt to get him back, and if you don't get him back, then you've met your requirement?
I think the judge took all reasonable steps. The statute is aimed at the judge. The judge issued a capias warrant. After the judge issued a capias warrant, it later came to his attention, years later, that there was a do not extradite written on the warrant. And it came to his attention after the petitioner sat on that for years before telling him.
And why didn't he know? I mean, if a judge issues an order, does it just go into the wind and the judge has no responsibility to docket the case, to note that it's still sitting there to see if his order was complied with?
Well,
as a judge, I would certainly want my orders complied with more than 13 years later.
Well,
sooner than 13 years later.
Right. I think the order, when the judge actually learned that his order,
he learned
less
a bunch,
than 13 years.
He learned that. A bunch of times, and then
yeah.
He did something new, but they kept not doing it. Wouldn't a judge taking all reasonable efforts bring in the sheriff or the prosecutor or someone and say, hey, I issued this order, why haven't you complied? I think most judges would have done that. I can't imagine we have orders just outstanding for years at a time that aren't followed up on in most courts.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I know that at the evidentiary hearing, there was a question asked by defense counsel that indicated that 83% of the warrants in that jurisdiction had don't extradite on them. So that may be a common practice, and perhaps in a larger jurisdiction more so.
Well, here the court ordered that removed, and yet nothing was done years before he...
Right. As soon as the court learned that it was on there, which the petitioner took years to bring to the court's attention, the court ordered it removed. A question at the evidentiary hearing indicates that a clerk sent a fax to the sheriff asking that the order be complied with, and it wasn't. So, I mean, that's the record we have.
And so all you have to do is say, I'd like you to comply with the law, and then whatever happens, happens. It's not our fault.
No
obligation to follow up.
The court issued a capias warrant. It ordered that it be followed. Under the Williams and Stelgis decisions, that's enough. If you remember the Williams decision as well from the Court of Appeals, there was a don't place in the NGRI written on the warrant in that case, and the Court of Appeals held the judge did enough. So under existing case law from the Court of Appeals, which my client followed, he complied with the statute.
And what about opposing counsel's argument that they asked for counsel to be appointed and that was not acted on?
The record would reflect, the docket entry would reflect that, but the statute doesn't require appointment of counsel. The statute requires the judge to take the all reasonable action to hold it within the period, which he did.
Is there a different standard for the court actions after the initial term of probation ends? I'm looking for the statute and I can't find it. It's take every reasonable effort prior to the end of the statute. What does the statute say about once the probation period's ended?
I don't know that it does say. I have always read it, the statute, to mean to take all reasonable effort and that not stop once the probation period is over. But if I'm wrong, I stand corrected. The statute doesn't contain language that, and it says, I guess, every as opposed to all, so I misspoke. Let me talk a little bit about the third thing, the writ of prohibition, before I go back to detail. I think this is an inappropriate case for the writ of prohibition where my client followed the law as it exists. The law on point for when persons are out of the jurisdiction is Stelgis and Williams. He followed that.
From this court?
From the Court of Appeals. There's no decision from this court that I believe to be on point.
But we need to follow the statute, which says all reasonable efforts.
Right, and that is the way the Court of Appeals has interpreted the statute. And also,
yes.
I would say, there's sort of a policy reason here that goes to the writ of prohibition as well. Because the point of bringing a person back And the point that the U.S. Supreme Court talked about in Daggett and in Nash is it gives the judge or a parole board the ability to evaluate someone's dangerousness having looked at their sentence, that is, and how they served it. The United States Supreme Court in Daggett said a revocation is foreordained if the last thing that the decision maker hears is that they've created a committed a serious crime in another jurisdiction.
Doesn't this invite the sheriff or others who to just ignore the court's orders with impunity?
I don't think so. But I think we're bound by the statute, and I think the statute is not aimed at the sheriff, but at the court, and the case law teaches the court did what it could do. And there's another thing that goes to the appropriateness of the writ here, too, is we have had a violation finding, but not an actual revocation with a sentence imposed. So it is still within my client's ability, if he feels that it is appropriate, to terminate the probation. It is still within his authority to give probation time credit.
The court has held a hearing?
They've held a hearing and
but not ruled.
They've held a hearing and found a violation. And then they set a sentencing hearing. Now, what one would assume is meant by a sentencing hearing is whether the probation will itself be revoked.
And how long has it been since he was brought back to the hearing and the court hasn't ruled on that?
It can't rule. The court held a violation hearing and then set the sentencing, and in the period after this court sent the sentence, after my client set the sentencing hearing, this court issued a writ of prohibition ordering him to take no further action. It was set for June. So, yeah, but for the writ, he would have resolved it one way or the other.
When was the hearing held, do you recall?
I believe it was May, and I believe the final was set for June, but the record would reflect. The transcript of the hearing where the violation was found is in the record. I'm going to talk a little bit about due process, since I'll go back to the beginning, and I promise to talk in more detail. Moody v. Daggett was a parole revocation case, and the United States Supreme Court found no due process violation because when a person is serving a sentence in another jurisdiction based on a conviction, the court found that there was not a benefit to the petitioner to hold the hearing immediately because the last thing that the fact finder would see and the first thing about him was that he committed a new crime in another jurisdiction. The court thought that it would be to the inmate's advantage to let the court have more information to see if he had rehabilitated himself in prison. Now, Karchman was a case which was not about due process itself, but was about whether or not the interstate agreement on detainers applies to probation revocations. And one of the reasons the United States Supreme Court held it did not was they looked at Moody v. Daggett analysis and said the same things apply here. That is, on a probation revocation, the court is going to be helped by information, but it would likely revoke if all it knew was the person committed a serious crime in another jurisdiction. So I think Moody and Karchman strongly argue that there is no due process interest that is violated by waiting until a person comes back from another jurisdiction. Although Moody is a parole case, and Karchman talked about Moody, but in the context of the interstate agreement on detainers. If we move on to the next factor, did the judge act reasonably under the statute? Well, did he act correctly under the statute by taking every reasonable effort? The answer that is given to us in Stelgis and Williams is yes.
Did Dotson overrule Stelgis?
I think not.
It was a year later.
Dotson was a person that was in the state. That is, he was in the Missouri Department of Corrections. So the factors that go into Stelgis and Williams aren't present in Dotson because it's fairly easy to issue a habeas corpus ad prosequendum or habeas corpus ad testificandum to bring somebody from the DOC. There's a whole other level of complication where somebody is hundreds of miles away and the state that has him may or may not send him back. I think in this case they probably would have, but we don't know that for sure from the transcript at the hearing. I think that is the main things that I have to say. No violation of the statute, no due process clause violation. The principal cases that we are relying on for no violation of this statute are Stelgis and Williams, which are the cases on point and which are from the Court of Appeals as opposed to this court, but they're the law as it exists now and they're well reasoned. Does the court have any questions? If not, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. There are circumstances under which the prisoner may have a legitimate interest in obtaining the prompt disposition of probation violation charge underlying a detainer. He may hope for the imposition of a concurrent sentence. Karshman versus Nash, page 734. The cases cited by the state support Mr. Zimmerman's position, as does the remainder of the federal case law. Even when we look at Doggett, in that case, the focus was on the fact that because it was a parole violation, he would get his good time credit. And the delay was incredibly short relative to Mr. Zimmerman's, a period of mere months. The court explicitly notes the good time credit issue within its opinion. Here, Mr. Zimmerman will receive no credit for his time on probation. Mr. Zimmerman will receive effectively consecutive sentences because this was not acted on in a timely manner. Further, the record is replete with examples of Indiana noting that it will gladly return Mr. Zimmerman to Missouri. His coordinator at the Indiana Department of Corrections, his caseworker, notes that they're waiting for Missouri to come get you. Indiana had somebody testify at the Missouri revocation hearing that they routinely send people to other states. Nobody in Indiana says that they would do anything but release Mr. Zimmerman to deal with this. Further, the states argued that it was a cost-saving measure that he was not paid, that they didn't pay for transit to bring him back. But Missouri brought him back. Missouri, when Mr. Zimmerman paroled, are the ones who drove out and retrieved Mr. Zimmerman. Further, because of the delay in this case, because the judge failed to take reasonable measures, Missouri will now pay, roughly, as far as I can tell, looking up the fiscal matters, $22,000 a year for Mr. Zimmerman's incarceration for a far longer period of time than what would have happened had the judge properly followed up on this. In addition, the state notes that it's in 2011 that the judge, we know, became aware of the no extradition language. What this ignores is that between 2011 and 2016, 5 more years pass. 5 more years, the term authorized by statute. Even if we start counting by then, there's a problem here. Once the court became aware of that language in 2011, they could have acted, even if we assume they had no knowledge before. But the judge doesn't act. He doesn't appoint counsel. He doesn't contact the sheriff and ask that his order be enforced. He does nothing for 5 more years.
What was the date that he was returned?
I believe it was January of this year that he was returned. I don't remember the exact date.
Why was there a 5-month delay before the hearing was held?
I do not know. I believe Mr. Barjon was appointed in March. February. After that, when it became apparent that Judge Dolan was going to revoke Mr. Zimmerman after this long of a delay, the case was referred to the appellate department, which is how I became involved in filing the writ, initially in the Southern District and then in this court.
Okay. Thank you. Case will be submitted.